The Culinary Institute of America held its 2014 Worlds of Flavor Conference at their Greystone campus in St. Helena, California. 70 chefs and presenters and over 700 attendees came together for Kitchens Connected on how creativity, millennial appetites, and culinary science are furthering the field of food. Peter Gilmore, Key, Sydney, Australia. Where were you born and raised?
Okay, so I was born and raised in Sydney, Australia. You want me to elaborate on that, do
you? Yeah. You know, what is Sydney, Australia? Where is it, you know, environmentally?
Yeah, well, look, you know, I mean, yeah, I was definitely born and bred in Sydney. You know, Australia is really quite an isolated country in a lot of ways. I mean, we're really sort of out there down the bottom of Asia. And Australians tend to be great travellers, actually, because we are so far away from the rest of the world. And, you know, when we do go travelling, it's usually for a long time.
You know, you had an interesting comment yesterday about importing.
Yep.
And Australia,
yeah.
You know, Australians being travellers, they don't bring much back or can't import much.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, as from a food perspective, Australia's, we're quite lucky, really, because Australia being a small continent to itself, I mean, our regions range from very tropical north to quite a cool climate in the south. So, you know, the produce that we have available in Australia is really incredible. And, you know, we have to import very little food. I mean, we really don't need to import anything if we didn't want to. In my kitchen, I would say I use 95% ingredients from Australia and maybe 5% of, you know, occasional, you know, exotic ingredient, like maybe some aged 10-year Korean soy or something like that.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about paragones, because you were talking truffles. It's one thing that Australia is actually exporting now.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So that industry is pretty new, actually. It's only about 10 years old from a, you know, sort of, you know, and I think even in the last 5 years, it's really grown a lot, and we're actually exporting a lot of truffle. But yeah, truffle's been grown in Western Australia, it's been grown in Tasmania, southern Victoria. And I know there was something like at least 10 ton of truffle produced last year in Australia. So every year that's growing, and more people are growing the truffles there. They're actually the Perigot black truffle that we're growing, and it's quality is incredible, and they're being farmed very successfully.
You travel. I know you were just recently in Germany.
Austria, actually.
Oh, in
yeah.
Austria. What kind of flavors, what kind of taste do you try to bring back and reinterpret in Austria?
Oh, look, you know, I think every time you travel, no matter where you go in the world, there's something you'll pick up. There's either a technique or an idea or a combination of flavors. You know, I was recently in Salzburg at Hangar 7, my menu was cooked there for a month. Which is a really great concept. They have a different guest chef every month and produce their menu for the whole month, which is great.
And how do you train the staff to actually produce? Do you spend that whole month there?
Oh, no, you don't. Well, you go really just for the first 3 or 4 days. I mean, they're very professional. They're used to dealing with chefs from all over the world. They're very well organized. Chef Roland is the executive chef there, and he spends about a week with you in your kitchen before you go, 6 months before you go to Hangar 7. And yeah, it's a really great, interesting process. And then you send all your recipes, and you know, he's familiar with them because he's spent that week with you. And then you go for the first 3 or 4 days, make sure everything's the way you want it. And yeah, I was very impressed with what they were able to do.
Were there any of your recipes that you had to tweak a little bit by being there, or any flavor profiles that changed?
Not really. I mean, they were able to get pretty much everything that I needed. You know, sometimes there's subtle things, and that's true whenever you do an exhibition of some sort. You never get the exact ingredient that you use in your own country, but you can usually get something pretty similar. I think you know, the idea of doing these seminars is trying to reproduce what you do in your country to give people an understanding of what it is you're producing. So there wasn't any major need to change things too much.
Let's talk about what you ate and cooked as a child.
Right. Well, look, as a child, I mean, you know, Australia is very similar to America in the sense that we're a country of immigration and immigrants, and we have a hugely multicultural society, and You know, I grew up in the 70s, and you know, it wasn't unusual for us to be at home. For my mum, who, you know, we have a Anglo-British background. I'm a fifth generation Australian, and but you know, it wasn't unusual for mum to cook a Chinese meal one night and the next night, you know, a traditional Italian meal, you know. So my mum and dad had friends from all different countries, and my mum learned to cook Italian food from one of her girlfriends at school in the 50s. You know, so really, it was a pretty diverse childhood, and we'd go out to eat all different sorts of nationalities' food all the time. So, and a lot of Australians, I think, had a, you know, probably a pretty similar experience. Certainly by the 80s, you know, the idea of what was eaten in Australia in the 50s, you know, which would have been pretty very much an English sort of diet, had changed dramatically. So, you know, we would go out and have a beautiful Thai meal, and then maybe go and have some Lebanese food the next night. You know, it's really, really diverse and great, because it opens your mind. And not having a really strong traditional food culture, like I think if you grew up in France or Italy, you know, your focus is probably quite traditional when it comes to your exposure of food. And for us in Australia, it's very wide. And so I think as a chef, it's given me the opportunity to have a very open mind when it comes to cuisine and exploring different techniques from different countries and different flavour profiles.
Do you find that there's an expectation of what you should be cooking as an Australian chef when you travel around the world? Are there dishes people ask you to make?
No, that's the thing. I think we don't have that at all. Like, where I think, you know, if you were a German chef, for example, traveling, even though, you know, these days modern food is so international, really, in a lot of ways. But I think there might be an expectation of the type of food you produce. And it might be, you know, sauerkraut and sausages, for example, or, you know, if you're an Italian chef, you'd be expected to make some sort of pasta, you know, and we don't have that as Australians at all, you know. No one really knows what to expect from an Australian chef, and that's sort of nice in a way.
Yeah, it's exciting to be able to completely tabula rasa it and, you know, go there and create a different palate. So you're defining yourself as a person rather than as a continent.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, look, I think most chefs on some level cook from their experiences, their personal taste memories as a child, and certainly influences as an early chef. But, you know, I think that's very diverse coming from Australia. And, you know, so I think combined with the diverse influences and great ingredients, we come up with some very different and exciting cuisine.
Talk about your restaurant. What's your current restaurant? How long has it been open, and what was the original concept?
Yeah, sure. Well, look, I've been at Key now for 12 years as the executive chef. 12 years have gone incredibly quickly. The restaurant was established when I came in there as executive chef. It had actually been a restaurant prior to that for about 12 years as well. And I think we're coming up to our 25th birthday now as a restaurant. You know, and the restaurant, the name change was originally called Bilson's, and then it around about the time of the year 2000, around the Olympics, the owner of the restaurant, Leon, decided to change the name to Key, because that's where the restaurant's located. It's at the Key, which, you know, in English, obviously, that means where the boats terminate, you know, and ferries and things like that. So it's a beautiful location, where we're basically opposite the Opera House. And the restaurant overlooks the Opera House and the Harbour Bridge. We probably have the most stunning location on the harbour. So, you know, the food has to work very hard to compete with the view. And, you know, I mean, so far, I think, you know, we've achieved that. And, you know, it's great. I mean, look, we've built a reputation over a long period of time. For the last 5 years, we've been in the San Pellegrino top 50 restaurants in the world, which is a huge honour. And and for a while there, we were the only Australian representative, so, yeah.
Let's talk about where the restaurant is located. Continue to kind of paint this picture of what environments around it and what kind of foods you bring in from those environments.
Well, look, Sydney is a beachside city. You know, where I live, I'm 5 minutes away from the beach. It's very similar to the climate of California, I'd imagine. It's a harbour city. It's one of the most beautiful harbours in the world. The restaurant itself, like as I said, overlooks the harbour, overlooks the Opera House, which is, you know, one of the most beautiful modern buildings. And, you know, it really has a great atmosphere. You walk in and you actually feel like you're floating on top of the harbour because it's in the overseas passenger terminal, which is where their really large cruise liners dock. So we have a pretty nice vantage of the harbour, that's for sure. So really, I think the focus, a lot of Australians love to bring overseas guests to the restaurant because it's sort of showing off the harbour. And, you know, we, as I said, we are really a very much a beachside, you know, water-orientated city. Lots of surfing and water sports and a great long summer that, you know, really lasts for 8 months of the year. So,
I mean, how do you translate that kind of scene into a flavour profile?
Well, I think if there was a trait for Sydney food, it would be that it's reasonably light. It's not a heavy base cuisine at all because the climate is so warm. You know, our winters, you know, we never get below zero. So it's quite a mild winter. You know, our seasons sort of tend to be pretty much warm and then very hot and then warm and then just a little bit cool. So our cuisine is, you know, based around that sort of seasonal sort of environment that we live in. So it is very fresh. Personally, my food, there's a lot of focus on texture. And because we are really in this sort of Asian region of the world, we have a lot of immigration from Asia. And so there's a big Chinese and Japanese influence, though it is subtle in my cuisine, but it is more about the use of texture and the playing off of different proteins against each other, like in traditional sort of Chinese cuisines, regional cuisines. There's a lot of emphasis on texture, and I really like that. And I sort of also feel that I really search for a sense of balance with my food in the flavours and the and just trying to find flavours that build on each other and tell a story. You know, flavour marriages are important. I'm not a big one for, you know, clashing flavours together on the plate. I really like to find some sort of harmony. And the idea of texture, like I say, is incredibly important to my food.
Let's talk a little more about travel and let's look at China.
Yeah.
I know you've done some extensive traveling there and brought back, you know, some of those ideas and ingredients.
Yeah.
What have you eaten in China and where? And then what have you done in Australia to kind of recreate that sense of memory?
Yeah. Well, look, really for me, most of my Asian influence really comes from our immigrants and eating in their restaurants in Australia. More so, I mean, I've traveled through Japan and, you know, Singapore and a lot of Asia, Hong Kong, and, you know, and eating in those countries is fantastic for authenticity. And but really, I think it's more about the sort of idea that, you know, after work we would go down to Chinatown because you know, there's a particularly good restaurant down there that's open very late. And, you know, so you do things like, you know, have a great big plate of XO sauce pippies or mussels, and you know, and those sort of flavours get under your skin. So one of the dishes that I'm actually presenting here at the conference is an XOC, which is five different types of seafood that's shaped incredibly thinly and just poached in a little bit of butter, just so the seafood's incredibly tender. But I make an XO sauce that's really combines the traditional techniques of the Chinese XO sauce, which is things like dried shrimps and dried scallops and dried Chinese ham and mushrooms and all the umami sort of flavours and a reasonable amount of chili. And I don't use a lot of chili in my food, but in this particular case, I do. And I make a very intense sauce, but then I also take that sauce and sort of, like you would a consomme, raft it with a whole lot of other ingredients. And it sort of brings it to a much more sort of perhaps refined, complex sort of sauce. And then the idea of all of the components that go into that, the XO, the dried scallops and shrimp and mushrooms that I explained, they become my garnish. So I do wafer thin slices and dehydrate scallops. I dehydrate lobster skin. I dehydrate shiitake mushrooms and some jamon, and that becomes my crisp garnish on top of my poached seafood, which is in the XO sauce. So it's a very modern version of that XO experience that I'd have down in Chinatown.
You know, what's so cool about that is for years chefs cared about authenticity. Not that they don't anymore, but this seems to be like a move away from that and becoming a chef d'orateur, you know, somebody that cares about personal experience more than getting something so spot on that, you know, that is the authentic version.
Well, you know, the idea of an authentic version is just a myth anyway, let's face it. I mean, if you ask an Italian what's an authentic version of something like a pesto sauce, you're going to get 100 different answers, and they'll passionately fight about it. You know, so I think that I think you can have a traditional flavor memory of a beautiful dish, and then interpret that with your own emotions and feelings and experiences, and that's what I think is exciting about cuisine. It continually evolves. So, you know, maybe a chef in 100 years might read my XO recipe and then think, "Oh, that was a really, you know, interesting traditional recipe from 100 years ago. Why don't I see what I do with it today?" You know, so I really think that that sort of thing is what moves cuisine forward. But I think you have to be respectful of tradition. You know, you have to have an understanding of flavors and an understanding of technique before you just jump in and try and do something different.
What ingredients and ideas that you can assume that we haven't seen in the U.S. are you exporting to today's conference?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think the world's a much smaller place these days with the internet and everything, and I think ideas get flown around the world quite dramatically. But look, I'm presenting quite a few things. One of the dishes I'm doing is a little quail dish, and on the surface it has a lot of European flavours. It's chestnuts, morels, a poached quail, a little brioche porridge I'm making from baked brioche that's crumbled up. But one of the textures that are in this is actually what I call a chestnut floss. And the inspiration for this particular floss was from a dim sum that I'm really that I love eating when I go to Yum Cha, and it's a little crispy yam dumpling, a very traditional Chinese dumpling, and it's very puffy and light, and it's fried, and it's quite delicious. And I thought, well, look, if you can apply that technique to yams, maybe you can apply it to another starchy type of tuber. Or anyway, so I chose roasted chestnuts to make this floss out of. And so it's a European flavour with a Chinese technique, and it actually uses ammonia bicarb, and that's what gives you the lift and the lightness. And all the ammonia, it's twice as effective a product than, say, bicarb of soda. So it's much more aggressive in the sense, and you fry up this chestnut puree that's had this ammonia bicarb incorporated, and it just puffs up and becomes incredibly light and crisp, and all the ammonia disappears as long as you cook it out properly. And so this floss is part of the dish, and that was inspired by dim sum. So I think that's where in that dish you could say that's a very uniquely Australian dish, because it's inspired by our immigration, it's inspired by what I eat. But I like to go out with my family and have dim sum, and you know, I looked at that texture and thought, wow, I wanted to recreate that in a sort of a modern sort of dish. And so that dish for me is uniquely Australian. It's uniquely me. It's from my experience.
So two things. I know you probably can't separate these two in your mind, but when you taste something, do you taste flavor first or technique first?
I often think that I taste texture first, and texture, like I say, is very important. And I think when you think about eating a lot of different things, like say you're eating a crisp apple, what is it that you're loving about that experience? Is it really, you know, the flavour? I mean, sure it is, but I think it's about what it's doing in your mouth. It's that crisp texture. When you're having an ice cream, it's about the texture of that cold, beautiful cream. So for me, often it's the feeling in the palate that I think you respond to, I know I do, the most. You know, if it's a beautiful bowl of perfectly al dente pasta, it's because that texture is fantastic. Or a bowl of slippery noodles, you know, it's, and then the flavour is, obviously just as important, but it's the combination of flavour and texture really that makes a truly great experience.
I'm presenting about umami tomorrow, and it's such a complex thing to be able to fit within an hour, yet alone everything else we have to talk about. But umami usually gets relegated to the softer textures, the mouthfeel, suppleness. Do you believe that's true, or do you think umami is more all-encompassing and deals with crispiness and exhilaration in the mouth?
Absolutely. Look, I think umami really is, like you say, it's a difficult thing to describe, but it is about savouriness, and it's about that fulfilling feeling, I think, when you eat something truly, truly savoury. And now, look, I mean, one of the things I do with umami is make a consommé that's based on all sorts of umami ingredients, and it's the intensity of that experience, anchovy water and roasted seaweed and all of those things. So it's just completely encompassing, and whether it includes a textural element, I don't know. It does tend to be associated with long, slow cooking, I think, so that maybe you're right in a respect that a lot of umami does seem to be quite, you know, soft in texture, or certainly cooked in texture, but it's not necessarily the case. I mean, one of the things I like to do is take the skin off a shiitake mushroom and dehydrate it, and it's incredibly crisp, but it's incredibly savoury, and the umami just jumps out of it. So umami is everything, and you know, shavings of Parmesan cheese is umami, you know. So I wouldn't say that's a soft texture necessarily either. So, you know, I think it can be what you want it to be. But for me, it's more associated with a feeling of savouriness than anything else.
Another thing I was talking about, a few Japanese chefs, in regards to umami, was the time and patience you chew and have something in your mouth, and how that develops, different flavors and different sensations.
Is that
something you put into play too, about how somebody eats your dish and how long it's in their mouth?
Yeah, look, I think that's a really interesting idea. I think that, I think that's sort of interesting. Like, it comes back to texture, you know, and what it is that you're actually eating, you know. And I think, for an example, I was talking about those shiitake skins. I do a dish with lots of shiitake skins and roasted seaweed, and it's on a green rice and a very slow braised piece of pork belly. And you know, that takes some eating. So yeah, I think that's possible that is part of it. And so I guess what you're saying is that they were saying the longer the flavors stay in your mouth, the more umami you're extracting.
Yeah, well, it's like the difference between, you know, again, umami being related to soft texture, but it takes that much more time to, you know, crunch through something, or beef jerky. You're sitting there and you're
Well, that's right, and that'd be very umami based. So I don't know. I hadn't really thought about whether it was crisp or soft, but I know, to me, you know, it is what it is. It's more about a flavour, and I guess you're right. It probably is associated with a lot of softer textures.
Yeah. I want to talk, because often you get asked about, you know, flavour memories. Let's talk about texture memories.
Yeah, right.
What are some of your favourite texture memories?
Oh, gee, that's interesting. You know, I mean, look, for me, I'm addicted to ice cream, I think. You know, eating gelato in Italy a couple of years ago with my family, we had a bit of a holiday there, and my boys and I would rate every gelato place we came across, and, you know, and I think it's really interesting that the ones that really shone through were when the texture was perfect, you know, and that's one of... Well, I'm trying to think one of my earliest textural memories. I don't know. I mean, baby food. Not much fun.
Yeah. Let's talk about the perfect texture of gelato. What is that? What got the highest scores?
Oh, look, I think when it was just about melting off your cone, but it's still holding together. You know, when the flavor is so fine on your tongue, there's no ice crystals. It's just pure cream, creamy sensation, but without too much cream. I think that's the key, you know. Gelato is about a very low-fat sort of ingredient that's churned at a very high rate of freezing to get those small ice crystals. especially if it's done traditionally in a traditional churn rather than a packer jet, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I find that a lot of chefs can produce a very creamy ice cream these days in a packer jet, but it takes a lot more skill to produce it in a traditional gelato machine. The ratios of sugar and fat or the binding agent, whether it be egg yolk or whatever it is, needs to be perfect, you know, for it to have that perfect texture. And it needs to be freshly churned as well. I mean, anything that's been sitting there more than a few hours, you can usually tell. It starts to get compacted and dense. So it needs to be light, it needs to be creamy, but it needs to be, you know, silky smooth. And light enough in fat that the flavours really come through. You know, I think that is the key to great gelato. And you can, I really believe you can tell when it's made with fresh ingredients. You know, like if you go to a real artisanal place and you know they've ground the nuts themselves, they haven't just opened a packet, you know. And there's that authenticity, and you know something's a little bit different. It's a little bit more edgier in flavour, and you know they're the places we were looking for. Yeah, and I think probably I think one of my favourite flavours was a beautiful cherry. It was cherry season. It was this cherry gelato. It was just amazing, and I think I had it with like an almond combination, cherry and almond. It was beautiful.
So we've done the soft. Let's do the hard, the crunchy, the chewy,
the crispy. Yeah. Yeah, well, look, one of the dishes I'm presenting here is the pig jowl dish, and jowl being the sort of cut that it is, it's got a lot of fat between the meat and the skin, so you have to trim a lot of the fat, and obviously you can't do a natural crackling. So one of the things I really like to incorporate is, you know, I think when people are eating pork, as part of a taste memory, you know, the crackling element is quite important. So we make the crackling out of Jerusalem artichoke skins. So we steam the Jerusalem artichokes, peel the skins off, dehydrate the skins slightly, and then slowly fry them in clarified butter until they become incredibly crisp. So you've got this incredibly crisp skin that actually tastes and feels very similar to pork crackling, but it has this incredibly earthy flavour. And with the pork, the jowl itself is multiple cooking methods. We cook it slowly in salted chicken stock brine for 8 hours, and then we smoke it over maple chips, and then we confit it in a mixture of juniper bay and jamon and clarified butter. So it has three cooking processes. It's incredibly soft. You can cut it with a spoon, and then you've got these beautiful shiitake. You have shiitake mushrooms and very thinly sliced, shaved sea scallops, topped off with the Jerusalem artichoke crackling. So it's just this mouthfeel of beautiful textures and quite intense flavours. It's one of my favourite dishes.
Most people tend toward the crispy. We're a society or a world of crispy textures.
Yeah.
What people crave. Are there any new textures that you're exploring, like a spongy texture, you know, a hot, cold, viscous texture? Are there?
Yeah.
Do you look towards texture modification before ingredients sometimes?
Yeah, sometimes I do, absolutely. I think there's a whole range of textures in between soft and crispy, I think. And, you know, and often they're quite subtle things, you know. And like the shiitake mushrooms, for example, that I'm doing in this dish, I actually peel them and shave them vertically to get a big surface. And they almost feel like abalone. They're so succulent and soft, and but with just enough resistance that you know you're eating something. And I think abalone actually is a great example of a really unusual texture, and you can do different things with it. And one of the things I like to do is get a very fresh. We have beautiful abalone down south in Australia and Tasmania. So the green-lipped variety, and we will shuck them and put them directly onto a slicer, have them paper thin, and then I will just basically heat them up in a little bit of ginger-infused oil, and they're literally cooked at 60 Celsius for 5 or 6 seconds in the oil, and they're incredibly tender yet firm. They're almost it's almost like a chewable elastic band that. That is actually yielding and soft and resistant at the same time. So, yeah, there's lots of great textures. I think Now, for me, the seafood and the sea provides so many incredible textures. I mean, sea urchin roe, caviar. You know, we do a dish at Key with raw smoked Wagyu beef, with horseradish juice, cultured cream, and we put over a fresh dory roe. So we actually extract the roe sacks from the dory and brine them ourselves. And that's mixed with just a tiny bit of olive oil and lemon zest. And so that the contrast of the soft yielding beef with the crisp roe next to it and that horseradish cream. And then we also add a little crisp sheet of milk skin to the mixture and some salty ice plant, which is quite crisp as well. So you've got all sorts of textures going off in your mouth at the same time. And I think that just that pop of the roe is probably the most important thing that's happening there. And so, yeah, look, textures, to me, they're so diverse. Like, something like caviar or roe, you know, gives you both. It gives you a pop and a crisp and a soft sort of centre. So, you know, multiple textures is probably something that I'm particularly interested in.
I guess that's why spherification is everyone's favourite and first, you know, molecular gastronomy. Like foray, because everyone wants to turn into caviar, which is like that mind-blowing texture.
Well, I guess that's true. I tend to want to look for those textures in natural ingredients as much as possible. It's amazing what you can do, and I think the Chinese are masters of texture manipulation. A piece of pork is cooked three or four different ways to achieve the final results, or a master stock chicken will be cooked to the point where it is, you know, so just cooked and all the juices are intact, and at that moment, you know, when you slice that chicken, it's so important that it's cooked to the right fraction of a second that or the dish is ruined. And that sort of refinement of texture, I think, is really impressive.
Heritage Radio Network is a member-supported nonprofit organization broadcasting over 30 live shows a week. To learn more and donate, visit our website or connect with us on iTunes, Stitcher, Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, and Instagram for more. Thanks for listening.